story, but it filters through so many different levels that it's fascinating. And I think it's, you know, in some ways, it's a testimony to Charles Koch. He is an engineer who looked at American politics and thought, how do you manufacture change here? What widgets does it need? What do you do? And he's been a terrifically successful businessman, and he's brought the country far in the direction that was considered fringe not that many years ago.
And some of the most surprising participants in the group that you didn't expect would be in the group?
Well, I think it's interesting that these New York finance people are in it, because for the most part, they don't share this radical worldview. They just care about wealth accumulation, basically. You know, I mean, David Koch's involvement himself in this. I mean, he's the wealthiest resident of Manhattan. His name is on every cultural institution here. He travels in circles that are full of open-minded people. Yet he's backing this machine that's pushing the country in a direction that I think many Manhattanites might be surprised at.
Jane Mayer, thanks so much for being with us. Author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. We're hiring a director of finance and operations, as well as a development director. Check democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Good evening, I'm David Kesters. Coming up next, we have the evening news. This KBOO program is made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, whose new play, Broken Promises, by Olga Sanchez, addresses teen prostitution in Portland. To find out more, you can visit milagro.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KBOO live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KBOO. Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. Radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Metro is preparing to vote tomorrow on whether to shutter its plans for an elephant reserve.
A federal judge has ruled Florida's policy of randomly drug-testing government workers unconstitutional.
And the UN has denounced France's new security laws for infringing on civil liberties.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 20th, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Governor Kate Brown was critical of the Malheur occupation during her State of the State address today, calling the armed occupation a, quote, spectacle of lawlessness. With the standoff costing over $100,000 a week, Governor Brown said she will be asking the federal government to reimburse the state for mounting costs. Meanwhile, the citizens of Burns had another community meeting last night. Residents of the small town voiced their concerns over the armed occupation by Ammon Bundy at the nearby Malheur Wildlife Refuge. During Tuesday night's meeting, residents repeatedly stressed that they want the occupation to end and for the militants to leave. At one point in the evening, the crowd of over 300 people shouted and applauded in support of the militants ending their armed occupation. Some of the armed militia members, including Ammon Bundy himself, attended the meeting, though they were not allowed to speak since the meeting was for Harney County residents only. The meeting happened a day after Ammon Bundy held his own meeting in the nearby town of Crane that drew a crowd of 30 people. During that meeting, the armed militia members encouraged local ranchers to tear up their federal grazing contracts. The armed militia members also re-emphasized that they have no plans to leave the refuge anytime soon. Bundy has stated that the armed occupation will only end when the disputed lands are no longer under federal ownership. Although the opinions of Burns residents are split regarding how the federal government manages public lands, the community has made it clear that they disagree with the militia's armed occupation.
Portland Cop Watch yesterday issued their lengthy review of the quarterly Portland Police Review Board report, finding a mixed bag of problems and progress in the citizen complaint process. The watchdog group faulted the analysis for its lack of detail about how officers interact with people in crisis. CopWatch also criticized the police bureau's consistent policy of refusing to name officers implicated in high-profile cases, even when they have already been named in the media. Out of 49 total complaints covered by the police review's quarterly review, 23 were sustained by the review committee. Chief Larry O'Day reversed one of the sustained findings in a case involving a confidential informant. CopWatch recommends that the police review board consistently include the incident date, information on who generated the complaint, gender of all persons involved, and the name of all officers, as well as more thorough background information on all cases. You can read the whole report at www.portlandcopwatch.org.
Portland Metro is planning to vote tomorrow on whether to cancel its plans for an elephant reserve. A $125 million bond measure passed by voters in 2008 promised larger enclosures and updated facilities on the zoo grounds. More humane conditions for elephants were specified, including increasing the elephant enclosure from 1.5 acres to 6 acres and having an off-site elephant reserve. Metro's agenda for tomorrow's meeting includes a resolution killing the off-site reserve. Metro now says the fund was never explicitly called for in the bond measure. During the bond measure campaign, the Oregon Humane Society urged voter support, saying, quote, "The planned off-site elephant respite facility should be Measure 2696's top priority," unquote. Oregon Zoo officials have fired staff, including the former zoo director, over a series of deaths of elephants over the past 2 years. Those deaths have included six cotton-top tamarins, and an orangutan. There has also been a recent disclosure that 10 staff members have contracted tuberculosis from infected elephants. The Portland Metro Council meets at 2 p.m. Thursday, January 21st, in the Metro Chambers at 600 Northeast Grand Avenue.
The saga of Portland's parking meter corruption continues. Former city parking manager Ellis McCoy was sentenced to 2 years in prison last May for accepting bribes from a representative of the Calais Group. The corporation says that the representative no longer contracts with the firm. Portland city officials have released documents showing that the Calais Group investigated its own corruption case with the city, the Oregonian reports. The company's investigation found that its representative did not bribe the city's parking manager to get a lucrative contract to build solar parking meters. City officials this week announced they are still under that contract and must purchase their machines from Calais. The machines are set to be installed on Northwest Portland streets next month. City officials say Calais blocked them from seeing the corporation's full investigation, but Commissioner Steve Novick says he's ready to move past it.
California became the second state in the nation to announce an investigation of how candid ExxonMobil has been with its shareholders regarding its knowledge about climate change. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke to Catherine Mulvey, with a union of concerned scientists on Exxon's alleged efforts to obstruct the public's level of awareness through a variety of techniques.
We are applauding this reported decision to launch an investigation into ExxonMobil because it really helps to move us closer to holding fossil fuel companies accountable for decades of deceiving the public and policymakers about the harm caused by their product.
Are there expectations that either the United States Department of Justice or Texas, that's the state where the company is headquartered, that they're going to follow suit?
Well, there are certainly calls for the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate. There are nearly 390,000 people who have called on U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch to launch a federal investigation into ExxonMobil. And there is certainly a need to look at the company's conduct and potential misconduct around the country.
Why these two states and what kind of charges can be brought?
I think the investigation will help to bring information into light that will clarify what the potential causes of action under state law might be. And what we've seen so far is that California has reportedly joined New York State in investigating whether this company misled its shareholders and the public. So the kinds of violations that might be at play could be in the realm of fraud and also looking at securities violations. This company, as we've documented in our climate deception dossiers, which was released last summer, have intentionally been spreading disinformation about climate science for decades. You know, we actually looked into the company's own internal memos that have come to light through lawsuits or Freedom of Information Act requests. And that shows that the largest fossil fuel companies knew the reality about the harms their products have been causing for decades. And we now know from subsequent further investigation by Inside Climate News and the LA Times working with Columbia University that their own scientists were actually conducting cutting-edge research decades ago. So the harms that we're already experiencing due to climate change could have been prevented if these companies had acted more responsibly.
Any idea what kind of timeline might apply, how long it might take to get to the next step?
I think that's going to depend a lot on the continued pressure from the public and calls by other policymakers to hold these companies accountable. And one example that we can certainly look to in recent years is how the combination of public pressure and action by state attorneys general helped to hold the tobacco companies accountable for the harms that they've caused to our society. At first, 20 years ago, it was just a couple of attorneys general that stuck their necks out, Mississippi and Minnesota. But as the public demanded that companies be held accountable for the enormous harms, the healthcare costs, and for lying to people about the dangers of their products and how they attempted to hook kids, that campaign really built momentum and helped to result in rapid changes in that industry. So through our campaigning, we're working to have a similar impact on the fossil fuel companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, and the trade associations and front groups that they hide behind as they are carrying out their deception.
What about your organization's charter make these matters relevant to you?
Our organization brings together citizens and consumers and scientists for effective policy on a range of issues, including climate change. And we really started to look at the fossil fuel industry because of the role that they've played in obstructing advances on policy to address climate change, and because of important advances in science that have happened in the last couple of years. A recent study done showed nearly two-thirds of all emissions since the start of the Industrial Revolution can be traced to just 90 investor and state-owned entities in the fossil fuel and cement industries. So that kind of science allows us to be able to begin to attribute climate impacts to specific companies and apportion responsibility for really damaging impacts on our climate. And that's why our organization is calling on ExxonMobil and others in the fossil fuel industry to make important changes that will demonstrate that they want to regain their social license, like actually realigning their own business models with the realities of a carbon-constrained world and paying the costs of adaptation and damages related to climate change.
I've been talking with Catherine Mulby. She's the campaign director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. For more information, you can visit their website at ucsusa.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Vaccination rates are up in nearly every county in California, according to data released Tuesday by California health officials. The Disneyland measles outbreak and a heated debate over vaccines at the state capitol is speculated to be part of the cause. Reporter Lisa Alaferis has more.
Vaccination rates are up in nearly every county in the state. That's according to data released yesterday by California health officials. The Disneyland measles outbreak and a heated vaccine debate at the state capitol may have had something to do with it. KQED's health editor Lisa Alaferis picks it up from there.
In the wake of the measles outbreak, lawmakers abolished the personal belief exemption. That's where parents can refuse vaccines for their children. The law doesn't take effect until this summer, but the personal belief exemption is down slightly, state data show. But that's not the biggest factor driving higher vaccine rates. It's schools, says Dr. James Watt with the California Department of Public Health.
The biggest change that we saw this last year was in the area of conditional admissions.
That's when kids who have received some shots but are not fully up to date can be admitted to school. The rule around conditional entrance is actually pretty strict. In general, if a child is behind, they're not supposed to be admitted. But too often, they have been.
Schools don't always apply the criteria for conditional admissions correctly, and they can be confusing.
That's why, more than a year ago, the Alameda County Public Health Department started working with schools on getting kids up to date. They've been successful. The state says Alameda had the largest increase of any California county in its rate of fully vaccinated kindergartners. Meanwhile, Nevada and Trinity counties had the lowest rates. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Alaferis.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo, featuring a live session with KBOO Program Director Aaron Yankee, speaking about the new KBOO archives. This will be followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be cloudy with occasional showers for the afternoon. The high will be 55 with a low of 47. Today in history, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day was celebrated as a federal holiday for the first time in 1986. Our quote of the day is from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools."
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let us now praise Lord Zuckerberg, the magnificent. Mark Zuckerberg, I'm talking about, the wonder kind of Silicon Valley who co-founded Facebook, amassed roughly $1 billion in personal wealth, and is now being hailed as a new giant of American altruism. That's because Mark and his wife, Priscilla Chan, after announcing the birth of their first child, stunned the club of uber-wealthy Americans by announcing that, in honor of the baby, they intend to donate $45 billion, 99% of their Facebook wealth, to charity. The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and other media outlets swooned at Zuckerberg's selfless act. Philanthropy pledge sets new giving standard, gushed Bloomberg News. But wait, lost in the fog of media adulation that has enshrouded St. Mark since announcing the donation are two important facts. One, the $45 billion did not actually go to charity. And two, it was not really a donation. Instead, as reported by Jesse Eisinger at ProPublica.com, Zuckerberg slyly slipped his fortune into, quote, an investment vehicle that he created for himself. Far from being a charity, this vehicle is in essence a getaway car, letting him stash his billions in it and speed away without paying taxes he would owe. That's not generosity, it's larceny, a perfidious looting of our public treasury by one of the richest creatures on earth. Moreover, despite reaping fawning praise for giving the money away, it hasn't really gone anywhere. His sneaky investment scheme is totally under his control, and he can use that $45 billion to buy his and her yachts, a small country, a U.S. senator, or anything else he wants. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, Zuckerberg is so rich he could afford to air-condition hell. And I think the worthless so-and-so would be smart to make that investment.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Michigan has more than 280 contaminated sites that are orphans, meaning the company that made the mess no longer exists and the state has to deal with it. However, Michigan is running out of money to tackle these environmental problems. That was not good news for Antrim County, home to one of the largest contaminated sites in the country. The Environment Report's Peter Payette has the story.
The southern part of Antrim County will have contaminated water for decades. A plume of a chemical called trichloroethylene has been spreading underground here since the middle of the last century. It can cause cancer. It was left by an auto parts manufacturer and has poisoned wells over miles of countryside.
We're driving through Summit Village here.
That's Donna Gundel-Krieg. She's a realtor.
And this is the village that's most affected by the plume at this moment. There are homeowners working to hook up to city water.
Summit Village is part of Shanty Creek Resort. The resort is one of the main drivers of economic growth in the area. But the chemical plume is migrating here and will contaminate more wells. That makes it awkward for realtors.
I was out here the other day putting brochures in, and these people came down and they said, tell us what you know about the plume we just bought last year, and our realtor didn't tell us anything. So I sort of said, well, it's a tough legal call, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I get that everywhere. You know, people want to know what I know, and I just don't really know what to say other than there is a plan. There is a plan, and we should feel okay about buying property here.
Property owners in Shanty Creek have this trouble today because of a fluid used to clean greasy machinery 50 years ago. Herb Tipton worked with that cleaner at Mount Clemens Metal in Mansalona in the 1960s. He says when they were done, they poured it down the drain.
But I don't think anybody really knew the after effects. Of course, that's true all over the world.
In Antrim County, trillions of gallons of water are contaminated. That's too expensive to clean up. So the state has spent $18 million to keep people from drinking the stuff, mainly by hooking them up to city water. But millions more will be needed to keep clean drinking water flowing around here. That's why community leaders were surprised in 2014 when they were told there wasn't enough money to extend more water lines. Dean Branson is with Three Lakes Association. He says it would have cost $2 million, but the state offered $500,000.
Which is defeat, because you can't do $2 million worth of construction with $500,000. So we needed to find a plan B.
The idea that Michigan can't afford to protect drinking water in Antrim County sent shockwaves through the community last year. Branson helped work out a novel solution, one that involved the county sharing some of the costs. That agreement will protect everyone's water for a few years, but then more money will be needed. Dean Branson expects the state will be there to help, because at a meeting this summer, a division chief from the Department of Environmental Quality told a room full of people that the state will protect their drinking water. Bob Wagner said if anyone asks the DEQ whether it's safe to buy property in Antrim County, the answer will be yes.
It's safe. It's fine. You're not at risk. Proceed as you would on any other real estate you're interested in. There is no risk. It's all managed. That's our message.
How to pay for that management long term is the question. There are more than 280 contaminated sites in Michigan that still need work, and there's no money to clean them up now. In fact, Wagner says the state might have to pull back on groundwater monitoring at some of these sites next year. For the Environment Report, I'm Peter Payette.
The ACLU, in conjunction with the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, has filed a letter with the FCC. The letter demands that internet gatekeepers be required to protect the personal information of users. Internet service providers, the gatekeepers of all information that flows over the internet, have access to massive amounts of personal data. Following the 2015 decision by the FCC to enforce net neutrality, the groups are calling for the FCC to enforce the protection of information shared through internet service providers, which are currently viewed as telecom services. Classifying ISPs as telecom providers leaves the door open for the FCC to require increased protections regarding the sharing of personal information between corporate interests. Those protections include making it possible for consumers to ascertain who their financial information is shared with and giving consumers a clear path to protect their information from being shared.
A federal judge has ruled that the Florida state's policy of randomly drug testing government workers as part of their employment qualification is unconstitutional. Florida Governor Rick Scott has made drug testing of anyone who receives government money a priority and recently signed into law a requirement that all state employees, except for lawmakers, be randomly drug tested. The Florida ACLU responded by immediately filing a lawsuit stating that drug tests violate the Fourth Amendment protections of state employees. Scott instructed his staff to put the testing on hold until the lawsuit was resolved. The finding represents the second rebuff of Scott's efforts to implement drug testing statewide, following a 2011 decision by another federal court in Florida that blocked random mandatory testing of recipients of temporary cash assistance, a Florida food stamp program.
Free Speech Radio's Shannon Young files this report about upcoming arguments before the Supreme Court regarding Roe v. Wade and abortion access in Texas.
Prior to the passage of House Bill 2, more than 40 abortion clinics operated in Texas. Now, only 18 of those clinics remain open, many operating under the terms of a temporary stay. If the Supreme Court ultimately rules to uphold the 2013 law, all but 9 or 10 abortion clinics in Texas will have to permanently shut down. HB 2 mandates abortion clinics meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers and requires doctors performing or inducing abortions to have admitting privileges to hospitals within 30 miles. Proponents of the law argued it would make abortions safer, but providers say the requirements were a political move intended to shutter clinics through expensive and unnecessary regulations. The full implementation of HB 2 would limit legal abortions to clinics in the cities of Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, and San Antonio, and possibly McAllen. Court documents estimate around 60,000 women seek an abortion in Texas each year.
The thought that a handful of remaining clinics in Texas can absorb the demand of our state's residents is utterly absurd.
That's Jenny Braun, former CEO and director of Ruth Street Women's Clinic, an independent abortion provider forced to close after 37 years operating in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The clinic temporarily suspended its services as challenges to HB 2 wound through the courts, but shut down permanently in June of 2015. Braun says that before the clinic shuttered completely, Ruth Street physicians saw an increase in women trying to self-induce abortions.
We did have patients come in that had obtained what they thought was Sodatec. We have no idea what it really was, at various flea markets or on the black market. And some patients had taken like 10 or 12 of those, which could be devastating.
As the number of clinics authorized to provide abortions in the state dwindled, wait times increased. Dr. Daniel Grossman is an investigator with the Texas Policy Evaluation Project, which published a study this month on how clinic closures have affected women's access to abortion services. Grossman notes that after the Ruth Street Clinic closed, wait times for an appointment at the area's remaining facilities increased from what was already around 20 days.
just this past December, these wait times in Dallas and Fort Worth increased to as long as 28 days for the first consultation and the mystery calls that we've been doing. And clinics said that it would likely be another 2 weeks after that before the procedure could be performed.
These extended waits, Grossman adds, have had a secondary effect, pushing more terminations into the second trimester.
The fact that HB2 is increasing later abortion is concerning from a public health perspective, since it is well documented that although second trimester abortion is very safe, it is associated with a higher risk of complications compared to early abortion. It's also more expensive for women, and there are fewer providers of later abortion.
The wait times and often long distances to the nearest in-state clinic have prompted some women to seek care outside of Texas. After the birth of her second child, doctors told Valerie Peterson she was no longer able to conceive. However, when surprised by a third pregnancy, Peterson decided to have the baby and began prenatal care. But by week 16, tests confirmed severe developmental irregularities in the brain and spinal cord that would not allow the baby to survive outside of the womb.
My doctor gave me two options. I could continue to carry the pregnancy to term, and I would eventually miscarry or give birth to a stillborn baby, or I could terminate the pregnancy.
Peterson opted for the latter. Although she lives in a city with an open abortion clinic, she soon discovered that wait times ranged upwards of 3 weeks. She says that added agony to what was already emotional devastation. A friend referred her to a doctor in Florida, and Peterson immediately booked an appointment.
So what I did have to do, of course, is secure an airline ticket. I had to secure hotel, and I had to stay hotel multiple days just to make sure that everything was going to go all right with the procedures. I had to secure care for my daughter, who was at home. And then I also, while in Florida, had to secure the assistance of one of my friends to take me to have the procedure to get it done. And so there was a lot of planning that happened and had to happen very quickly, because as we know, the longer it takes, the more expensive it is for the care to happen. And this was not covered by my insurance policy, so this is something that I had to do very quickly.
In all, Peterson estimates the out-of-state abortion cost more than $5,500. Meanwhile, those abortion providers still able to operate in Texas report severe strain on their resources. Of the 10 facilities that could remain open if the Supreme Court upholds HB2, half are operated by Planned Parenthood. Ginny Braun of the now-defunct Ruth Street Women's Clinic says even if the High Court overturns HB2, there are no plans to reopen the facility she used to run.
It's sort of like once Humpty Dumpty has fallen off the wall, you really can't put him back together. So at this time, I'm still working on issues related to the closure of the clinic, such as equipment leases, taxes. As you may know, independent providers are taxed at 35%, not like some of the Planned Parenthoods. So just because we're closed does not mean that the expenses have stopped. So for the time being, no, there is no plan for Ruth Street Women's Clinic to ever reopen.
The Supreme Court is due to hear arguments on Whole Woman's Health versus Cole on March 2nd. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imanc.org for Wednesday, January 20th, 2016. Israeli troops demolish homes in the West Bank and attack farmers in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Three Palestinian homes were demolished by the Israeli army on Wednesday during invasions in different parts of the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. Israeli soldiers demolished on Wednesday an under-construction Palestinian home and its surrounding wall in Beit Arosh village south of Hebron in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. On Wednesday at dawn, the soldiers invaded Wadi Kaddoum neighborhood in Silwan town in occupied Jerusalem and demolished an under-construction home after surrounding the area. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan said that the demolished property belonged to Samer Nasser and was leveled without a prior notice. The building was 300 square meters. After demolishing the home, the soldiers also bulldozed and destroyed its ground foundation. Nasser started building his property 3 months ago with a cost of more than 180,000 shekels. Moreover, Israeli soldiers demolished on Wednesday a newly built Palestinian home in Beit Hanina neighborhood north of occupied Jerusalem. The family was preparing to move to their residence next week. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan said that the soldiers surrounded the neighborhood before invading it and demolished the property that belongs to Palestinian woman identified as Hiba Abu Asab and her 4 children, 8 to 14 years of age. In December of 2014, the family was forced to demolish its home and was forced to pay 20,000 Israeli shekels fine, allegedly for building it without construction permit. The family is still repaying construction costs, fines and debts. In other news, the Palestinian Prisoner Society said that the Israeli soldiers have kidnapped on Wednesday 31 Palestinians, including several children, in different parts of the occupied West Bank. Dawn and morning invasions, in addition to home searches and kidnappings, were reported in Bethlehem and Hebron cities, in addition to Jenin and Jerusalem. In the Gaza Strip on Wednesday, several Israeli military vehicles invaded Palestinian farmlands east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, bulldozed and uprooted lands close to the border fence for the second consecutive day. Soldiers fired several live rounds to force the Palestinians out of their lands, Palestinian sources reported. Damage was reported, but no injuries. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, January 20th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi, Ami, Ghassa, Bandura.
As many as 4,000 families in Zimbabwe are in limbo after facing down bulldozers during the holidays. At least 1,000 others became homeless after officials ordered their houses demolished just before Christmas, the latest in a series of settlement evictions and demolitions. All told, about 20,000 families were left homeless last year in the metropolitan area of Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Authorities argue the homes were built illegally on squatted lots and cite a shortage of available lands in the city. That shortage of land for the country's poor was one of the reasons used years ago to justify large-scale government expropriation of white-owned farms. Garika Chaunza reports.
The current housing crisis in Harare has been more than 20 years in the making. That's how long it has been since the Harare City Council zoned any new land for private homes. The local government largely, though never officially, relinquished land use control to independent housing cooperatives controlled by mainly ZANU-PF politicians. The result was a system of political patronage in which aspiring home builders aligned themselves with a handful of ruling party power brokers. Now the city council is trying to regain control of zoning. But rather than grandfathering in the settlements that grew on disputed land during the past 2 decades, city officials are targeting homes constructed without formal council approval and ordering their demolition with only 48 hours' notice. Michael Chideme is the Harare City Council spokesperson.
For the past 20 years, we have not been surfacing land, but now we have realized that to fill the gap that has been created, we are going to surface land beginning this year. And we have also realized that people were being cheated of their money by unscrupulous management committees of housing cooperatives. People were, have been paying money for the past 10 years, 15 years, but with no meaningful development on the ground.
Beginning in 2000, the government began expropriating white-owned commercial farms, saying it needed land to provide housing for the rapidly growing Zimbabwean population. But it wasn't everyday people in need of housing who benefited from these land seizures. It was ruling ZANU-PF leaders, some of whom became land barons in their own right, parceling up and selling the land they had acquired through political spoils. Now the people who bought those parcels are paying the highest price as demolitions move forward. In November, President Robert Mugabe ordered another spate of demolitions, this time at Dunstan Farm, home to 5,000 people. The land on which Dunstan Farm sits belongs to a politician Mugabe sacked from his ZANU-PF party last year. Mugabe argues the settlement, which is near the Harare International Airport, is an eyesore that tarnishes the image of the country. Acting on the president's directive during the Christmas holiday, the Harare City Council ordered city workers to storm the settlement and demolish all of the homes there. They cleared nearly 1,000 houses before the area's local Member of Parliament Shadrick Mashayamombe intervened, appealing for more time to arrange for alternative housing for those displaced.
We managed to stop City of Harare from demolishing those structures. This is rain season. There are a lot of diseases associated with the rain season. So we said, no, can you wait to give us ample time for us to finish the relocation process? Then after finishing relocation, then you will come and demolish all those structures. But those structures will be empty structures without roofs because people are removing their roofing sheets.
But not only are residents still waiting, they say alternative shelter isn't enough, claiming they paid for the parcels of land. One middle-aged woman whose Dunstan Farm home was destroyed before the demolition was interrupted says her family was left with nothing.
Our children and our properties are outside, and we have nowhere to go because they just came here and destroyed our houses.
And despite successfully negotiating a pause in the destruction, one local resident says MP Mashayamombe hasn't followed up.
The MP came here and promised us that he was going to give us alternative accommodation and never returned.
As the uncertainty continues into the new year, another resident worries about access to basic hygiene and sanitation.
We do not know if it is proper health-wise to be settled where there is no water and no toilets.
For the past 2 years, the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights has been challenging housing demolitions under a provision of the new constitution. Enacted less than 3 years ago, the document grants every citizen the right to shelter. The group's program manager, Zimbabwe Chimba, says the legal maneuver has been successful in other cases.
The lecturer calls upon the state and all institutions and agencies of government at every level to take reasonable steps as provided for under the constitution and within its limited resources to ensure that rights are enjoyed by all without discrimination. As Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, we will continue to pursue justice for victims of human rights abuses in Zimbabwe and provide a vital democratic lifeline for citizens who would otherwise have no recourse against state-sponsored abuses and persecution.
Zimbabwe's new constitution also states that authorities must seek a court's permission before demolishing private homes. If permission is granted, authorities must find alternative accommodation for the displaced and compensate them before relocation. But so far, that hasn't happened. For those people still living at Dunstan Farm and expecting demolition crews any day, it remains to be seen if the state will honor its obligation under the nation's new constitution. Garika Ichaunza, FSRN, Harare.
Recent terrorist attacks in France have resulted in the French government restricting civil liberties. After the Paris attacks back in November, the French government declared a state of emergency, leading to hundreds of raids and over 100 people placed under house arrest, all without judicial authorization. The current state of emergency allows for the government to conduct warrantless searches, place suspects under house arrest, and limit people's rights to peacefully assemble. French President François Hollande is seeking to extend the government's state of emergency powers by altering the country's constitution. Included in these changes would be the government's ability to strip French citizenship from those convicted of terrorist offenses if they have dual citizenship. Civil rights advocates argue that such a move would cause a division in French society, creating two classes of people, where one class is under threat of losing their citizenship. The UN Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights released a statement yesterday calling France's restrictions excessive and disproportionate to the current state of emergency. The UN experts are urging the French government to uphold the citizens' fundamental rights and to resist curtailing freedoms in the name of national security.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Galen Sanford, and our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. Local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty interviews Jessica Campbell of the Rural Organizing Project about the Burns occupation and community response. At 9 o'clock, hear Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering speaks with Michael Clare about his article, There Will Be Chaos, Big Oil, Big Oil's Collapse, and the Birth of a New World Order. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, host David Nyman speaks with Keith Lee Morris about his novel, Traveler's Rest. And at 11:40, it's a special Words and Pictures with the directors of the animated feature The Box Trolls, the third feature film from Oregon animation studio Leica Entertainment. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support to keep KBOO on the air. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.